Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gowland, and joining me for this segment is State Senator Tom Casperson out of Escanaba. He's a Republican who's also running for the 1st Congressional District here in Michigan. Tom, this is our first time being able to sit together. Welcome to the program.
It is. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Now, you're up here doing a nice little tour through the Upper Peninsula. Tell me what you've seen so far.
Well, we've stopped in and met with some of the kids in some of the schools over in Lawrence. We stopped there. We've also went to Northern Hardwoods. Kind of my background, looked at the sawmill over there that's been there for a while, but I think it's something that's kind of out of sight, out of mind. A lot of people don't realize what we have over there, and it's really remarkable with the technology they have, the opportunities they have. They're talking about potential expansions. Markets are good, and we're producing that lumber right here in the Upper Peninsula in northern Michigan. So it's something that I've been involved with my whole life, and it's something I've certainly made an issue out of down in Lansing that these types of opportunities are there. We need to promote them.
And what about obstacles? What are people asking you to go back when you get back to Lansing after the break's over that they want you to get on?
Yeah, the big thing, which we've always been pushing on, is the regulatory side of things. People, especially small business people, they want clear direction. They're not against some rules and regulations. They just want to know what the playing field looks like and then let them go to work. What they're concerned about is the mindset that comes in and says, well, it might have worked today, but tomorrow we're going to change it and give you some new rules and new regulations, and gives them an uncertainty as to what their future holds with the business. So we're trying to stabilize that so we get long-term visions when it comes to the rules and regulations. The big thing right now for the Upper Peninsula, I think probably the biggest issue we're faced with, and it even includes the average citizen with their home, and that is electricity, the power bills, and where is all that heading? There's been two mindsets. Actually three. Some have talked about building more generation. Some are talking about more transmission. I've been working on the transmission side of it, and I also believe that it's a combination. I do think there's a place for some more generation. I think what we're going to see is it's going to be more targeted, more centrally located in regions where it's needed. We're so diverse and widespread across the Upper Peninsula, it gets harder and harder to think that we could just build one big power plant and take care of things. It doesn't quite work that easily. So that's what I see. I see that we're going to come up with some smaller power plants where they're needed, and this area probably would be one of those areas people would be looking at to do that. And so energy is a big concern for everybody, and where the future is going to take us with that.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because in the second half of this program, I'll be sitting down with Sam Lockwood. He is from the Keweenaw Renewable Energy Coalition. And they were tasked with coming up with a plan that would make the Upper Peninsula energy independent. Mm-hmm. And I'll let him explain it later on in the program, because he'll do a lot better job than I will. But it's, you know, looking at kind of what you're saying is taking all the different options we may have here in the UP and putting them together for one big overall plan to, you know, try to address some of the problems that we have with getting energy here.
Yeah, it is a problem. And if you're talking about growth and expansion with our companies and our businesses and our job opportunities, if the first thing out of the gate a company has to deal with is, can I get enough energy, and what's the cost going to be? And if we're not competitive in some of those areas, and if there's a struggle to get the energy that's actually absolutely needed, hard to bring in new business. It's hard to expand. So we got to come up with a better way to be a little more reliable. And I like what you just said about the renewables. That's a great thing that people are actually working on something like that, trying to find ways that we can be more independent in what we're doing. Clearly, what happened in the last few years with Wisconsin Electric and what happened with Presque Isle, Wisconsin kind of showed where they were at. And I say that not to blame Wisconsin. I understand their dilemma. There was going to be added cost to a lot of Wisconsin ratepayers if they kept if they stayed in the same footprint that MISO has us in over the last 40 years. But they chose not to, which then put that burden right on top of the UP ratepayers. So We better come up with solutions to be independent or find other ways to tie us in, which I'm working on to tie us in with Lower Michigan, so that at the end of the day, we do not completely find ourselves dependent on Wisconsin. I'm loyal to Wisconsin in one area, Green Bay, and that's about it. I'm a Michigander.
We'll differ on that. I come from the Detroit area. And speaking of the Detroit area, because we're about, you know, somewhere 600-700 miles away from Detroit, yet people will wonder, well, why do we keep, you know, paying attention to what's happening at Detroit Public Schools?
Right.
And my answer to that is we have to, because that's going to affect us, or could possibly affect us, and money we have available here. Could you give us an update with, you know, I know the state legislature just, approved some emergency funding. Then some other news came out, which kind of puts a black eye on the whole thing. And now you got to still, you know, pick up the pieces and move forward.
Yeah. The package that they were working on in the Senate did create some relief with some stipulations and some parameters put around it. For clarification, I was missing for the vote. There's my opponents. I'm running for Congress. Some of my opponents are trying to make hay with that. I just want your listeners to know I did miss that vote. So what I did was announce where I would be at on Thursday when I came back. I let I put it on the record where I would have voted had I been there. So I say that up front. But I didn't support it, and mainly because right now the way they were going about it, or at least the money approach to it at this point, is hurting everybody else, because we're going to be taking money that could go some other places. And I'm not so sure that they've got it exactly straight of what they're going to do. We had Mayor Duggan come in and address our caucus. I'll give you an example. He's concerned because the schools have cropped up cropped up in one region. So you got all these schools in one region. When you think of Detroit, it's very large. It's not like having a bunch of schools in the side of the city of Houghton. I mean, it's pretty close proximity. This is in one area inside of Detroit. So all the other regions where there's a population base and there's kids that need to be educated, they got to find a way to get them all into that area. They haven't solved that problem yet. And so what I'm suggesting is they need to be looking at ways to scatter the school system out a little bit to be more proactive in some of these other communities. For whatever reason, that one region seems to be the hot spot or the popular spot, so everybody's focused on that. And that includes charter schools. You hear a lot about charter schools. They've done the same thing. They're all in that hub. So if they're really going to try and fix this, I think they have to meet kind of the neighborhood somewhat where they're at. And I don't mean having a school in every single neighborhood, but certainly population basis could determine it. They haven't done that yet. So they're putting money into it, and it appears to me they're going to put it in that centralized spot. And even the mayor didn't completely agree with that when we talked with him as far as how they're doing it. So that was one of my concerns. But even beyond that, a bigger concern now is these federal indictments were handed out with the school administrators down in Detroit. There was 12 indictments. To me, when you look at what happened there, I think that's been kind of the sore spot of Detroit to start with. And that is, every time we try to go in and fix something, the folks internally, the people that represent the Detroit area, they constantly talk about how the state didn't give them the money they should have gotten. It's always the state's fault. We didn't give them enough, or we didn't keep our commitments and those type of things. And I'm sure somewhere along the way you'll find that. I wouldn't argue that, but you can't tell me that it's always somebody else's fault. And then you find out that you had these people in the administration in Detroit that were... it appears they were using some of the school money for lining pockets and doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. I think it would be a breath of fresh air if somebody down there would say, listen, we've had some problems down here and we've made some big mistakes ourselves, but we do need help and we want to work together. The minute we hear that, I think you'll see this whole thing start to clear up and really, then there's an opportunity to really fix things. But right now, we're still not hearing that. We're still hearing the blame game and telling everybody else how wrong they are. And it's just a matter of we've been picked on it. I think there's got to be a better balance.
Isn't the emergency manager that's been appointed to oversee Detroit schools and has, you know, there's been one in place for some time that's supposed to, you know, head these kinds of problems off of the past and find these, sort of situations so that they're not crippling the school district?
Right. And that's a good point, because the emergency manager has been there, and that would make my point. And that is, since the emergency manager has been there, we've heard nothing but he's the reason for the problems. And he's caused the problem. So I would argue, why did the emergency manager get sent in there in the first place? They're not being sending them into everywhere. They're sending them into areas where financially they're collapsing, they're struggling, and they can't seem to make ends meet. That's the purpose for the emergency manager. Somebody's got to make these tough decisions. And again, I would argue, we're not hearing that we agree that some tough decisions have to be made. And yeah, maybe we made some mistakes along the way. Let's come together and solve the problem. We keep hearing, if it wasn't for the emergency manager, it wouldn't be a problem. If it wasn't for the state legislature not giving us the money they owe us, if it's not the governor's policies, and we keep hearing that. And again, I don't deny that. I don't think anybody's perfect. So I can't sit here and say that every policy, every idea that's ever come out of the legislature is right or the perfect fix. But we're not getting any acknowledgement that they've created some of the problems. And yes, we need help, but let's work together to fix it. I think we're getting close because things have gotten that bad.
The next issue I want to talk about is certainly one that is getting a lot of attention. It's stirring up a little bit of controversy. This is involving the proposed guidelines by the State Board of Education on what to do with LGBTQ students in our schools and allowing them to have certain freedoms to express themselves. And among those are, you know, being able to identify themselves as their own, with their own name and their own gender, choosing which bathrooms they will be using, which locker rooms. Also, which school programs that they're involved in. If they're gender-related, that they would be able to participate as the gender that they feel they identify with. You are planning on doing something in response to this. I'll let you explain it.
Sure. When we found out about it, which was just a few weeks ago, in the policy, I think it's important to note that the policy had come out of the department back in February. And when we questioned that as to why would something of this scale, this is a big deal all the way around, and it's an important situation. So why would something like that, why wouldn't that have been a press release or something to notify the public that the school board was going to make a decision like this? We were told that it was public because they hold their board meetings online. So you can go online and watch the board meeting. So that's their public notification. And there's some truth to that. I mean, if somebody knows about it, they could certainly go look at it. But I thought there should have been more than that. And I think I'm vindicated in that now that the public is aware of it, you see the response coming from across the state. As of yesterday, I think they've had 6,000 responses to this thing. I've been told that that's rare, 15, 20 responses to a policy normally, over 6,000. So no matter where you line up on the issue, it's something that we need to have some discussion about, I think, and parents for sure need to be involved in this. So that's where I got engaged. Was one of the policies was that a child could go to the administration and tell them that they're struggling with their identity, and I think we need to take that very serious. And I think we should be listening to the children when they're coming to us with these problems that they feel they're having as far as being uncomfortable, whatever the case might be, we should be listening. But I got concerned when I heard that the child, if they request the parents aren't involved, then the school doesn't involve the parents at all. And in fact, we'll allow for the child to change their name so that it fits the gender that they've chosen for themselves. And in fact, reading through the policy, it even goes farther than that, because for parent-teacher conferences, they'll require the teacher to go back to the traditional name that they originally had at birth to interact with the parents. So this whole thing is cloaked under kind of a quietness that the parents are left out of the equation. So that concerned me. That was number one, and I think that's got to change. We're requiring it in the legislation that absolutely the child has the right to make the request with their parents, with them making the request. So that should be a team effort there to solve that problem. We also understand that there are cases where there's problems at home. And we saw this much, it would be much like what happened when we ran into some scenarios with younger women that are young girls that found themselves pregnant and were actually looking at abortions as an option. If you require them to go to the parents, in some cases there was abuse at home. So the girl really was put in a no-win situation, having to go back to the parent. So in that case, they allowed for the courts to intervene through the request of either the administration, the school, or friend or family that felt there was concerns. And so what we're doing, we're suggesting, is that we do the same thing here. If there's a case where friends, family, somebody who knows the child makes the petition that it's not going to work putting that child back in the home or making the parent get involved in the process, then we feel the courts have the right to weigh in on that and help the child get through that scenario. But just the carpet blank to say all parents, if the child chooses not to at a very young age, they don't want parents involved, to say they're not going to be involved, that concerns me, that the school board thinks that they somehow know better what's better for the child than the parent, doesn't feel right. There's something wrong there. And then the other part of it was the intermingling of the two biological sexes. So to suggest that it's we just need to integrate a young boy that feels that he really is a young girl, to not recognize the fact that he biologically was born a boy, and suggest that it doesn't mean anything to put that person into a locker room setting with young girls, I think is, I just don't think there's any common sense in that. And so what we're suggesting is that provisions are made for the young person that struggles with the identity. And I think that's totally appropriate to make sure that we, number one, make provisions for them that are needed. If it means a single bathroom setting, they have access to all of that. I don't see a problem with that. Now, some are suggesting that that's segregating them and that'll deepen the problem even more. Except when that was questioned, I read through the policy, and if you put, let's say, a young boy in the locker room with young girls that traditionally are used to being with just young girls, and all of a sudden they know that this person coming in is physically a young boy, so you have scenarios now where young people are uncomfortable, and they don't feel, they feel their privacy is being violated. So they go to the administration. This is part of the policy. So the administration's fix to that is they'll set up segregated scenarios for those individuals that went from a traditional setting where there was no problem to now segregating them out to say they must have a problem because they don't feel comfortable with this young boy in the locker room with them. So we're going to allow them to have single bathrooms. We're going to set up scenarios for them to have different locker room settings and everything else. So to me, it's like we're setting up another problem to fix a problem. And I think we got to be very careful with what we're doing. And I don't think the overreach, in my opinion, of what the school board came up with is an overreach. We both acknowledge we need to help and we need to be sincere in our concern over the child that requests help. But it just seems like there's better solutions to this. There's more common sense approaches that can be taken. And they really left the door wide open as to the solution, and it seems like it's one-sided. ACLU said that we were invading on the privacy of the young child, what I was suggesting. Well, what about the privacy of the little girl or the young girls in the locker room? Their privacy goes out the window, and we need to better swallow it and accept it. There's something wrong there that it's we can do it one way, but not the other. I suggest and have suggested that the concern for the school board should be for every child, not just one group of kids that are maybe struggling with something, but all children. And we certainly shouldn't be setting policies in place that are going to try to help somebody out that creates problems for others over here. And I think that's where the fight is. And I think the 6,000 calls, and that was as of yesterday, so I can imagine how many there are today. There's a lot of people in Michigan agree with me.
Now, when coming up with your response to propose this legislation, did you speak with people of the transgender community to try to get their input and try to come up with something that they may be open to? Because my conversations with the LGBT community is that they're not happy with this, that this is sort of a step back rather than a step forward.
Sure. Yeah, what I did was I read through the entire policy of what their conversations were with the school board. And that's where we came up with our conclusions. And I guess I understand that they might say that, but again, I think we need to have an honest conversation as a community. And the whole issue of privacy and everything else, I would just simply say, there have we lost all common sense? It's just a matter of we're going to blend kids together and everybody's just going to be happy and live with it. And I don't see that because I don't know when it's ever been a natural scenario that you can put young boys and young girls together in those type of settings, private settings that we're accustomed to, and just suggest somehow that they're going to blend together and we won't have problems. When have we ever done that? And that's the part that I think is missing in the conversation. Nobody has suggested, and that's the other part, nobody suggested that we don't try to help these young people that are struggling with the identity. Yet, if you look at the comments that are being made, a person like myself is accused of ignoring them or suggesting that I don't believe they have a problem and I just want to throw them into the wolves. And I've never said that. I've never insinuated that. I have constantly said that they have a legitimate right to come in with their concerns. The debate really is over to not that they don't have a right to the concern and we need to work some solutions out. It's the solution is where the debate is. And as of right now, it appears to me that a lot of parents are with me, and rightfully so, because I'm a parent. And I can tell you, if my young daughter was in a locker room setting and I found out the school, without even telling me, was going to set a young man in there because he's struggling with something and that somehow that's going to fix his problem, I'm going to have a problem because my daughter's in there. And I've heard comments that there's no evidence of any problems. You've got the College of Pediatricians. I read their report. Completely disagree with this and where we're going with this. So you've got professionals in that field completely disagreeing, but I'm supposed to listen to, and the parents are supposed to listen to, the school board, the Department of Education, in their infinite wisdom, and came up with the solution and ignore people that are actually professionals in the field. I think they have very good legitimate reasons for what they're saying. And so I hope I'm not coming across that I'm an expert in all this. I'm not, but I'm a parent and I am concerned that we're going at this like it's not a big deal and don't worry about it, it'll just take care of itself. And I don't think it will. I think we're going to create problems if we don't apply some common sense here to the solution.
We have about 2.5 minutes to go, and we also want to be able to talk about you're running for a U.S. seat in Congress, 1st Congressional District of Michigan. Tell me, what was the motivation to jump from the state level to try to go for nation?
Sure. Well, part of it is timing. There's no way of denying that. It's difficult to get past an incumbent that sits in the seat. In my case, with Michigan, we have term limits. I'm in my last Senate term, so I've never shied away from the fact that I would be interested in making a run for Congress, simply because you got two scenarios with the term limits and then what I've seen from the state level of what we're dealing with. And a lot of what we're dealing with is, in my opinion, a lot of overreach from the federal government into the states. I am absolutely convinced that most of the governing should take place on the state level, and the federal government should be a limited role in what they're doing. And there is no way that anybody could look me in the eye and tell me that the federal government has not gotten to a point that they're overreaching and stepping into the states and kind of dictating. And how they do it is through money. They take money from us, and then if they want to give it back, it's always with strings attached. And if we end up taking the money back, then we have to comply with all the strings that are involved from the federal government. So in the works that I've worked on, the issues I've been working on, every time I turn around, actually, we run into that scenario. And I know that we could fix and solve some of these problems, and we have fixed some of them on the state level. Land would be an example. The lust for the department and the government to own land is incredible in the state of Michigan. It's absolutely incredible. I've got counties that are 75% government-controlled, whole counties. Baraga County is one that's really struggling with the combination of those type of entities controlling the land. There's no taxable land base, so you're trying to run a local unit government to provide services, and there's no land base left, and they keep looking for more. So we've been able to push back on some of that, but at the same time, you look at some of the policies that are being implemented by the departments. They'll use fish and game funded land as an example. They'll get the money from the feds to buy the land, and then they impose all the rules that come with it. And so all of a sudden, there's all kinds of restrictions on that land for you and I as citizens of Michigan to go use the land. It's those type of things, and I'm giving you one example, but those type of things, in my opinion, are a fast overreach of what the public thinks they're getting versus what they're actually getting. And it's because the federal government, I'm convinced, believes they need to control just about every aspect of our life, and they're doing it. If you look at the EPA, went after our wood boilers. I'm miffed by it. I don't understand it, how they can even think what they're thinking when many people rely on those things just for average household heating to survive a tough winter. They burn wood. And here comes the EPA telling us that we can't burn with those wood boilers unless they comply with the standard they came up with. And by the way, the standard they came up with, we found out in committee, will kill the boiler. You can't meet the standard. In fact, a campfire, when you go camping with your family, that fire can't meet the standard. The smoke emissions that the EPA came up with for these wood boilers, your campfire can't meet it. Your fireplace in your house can't meet it. Now, they're telling you that because they know they'd probably get a pretty good size outcry if you started taking people's campfires away from them and their fireplaces in their home. But It's those kind of things that are what we're dealing with, and I'd love an opportunity to go to the federal side of things and try to find ways to pull back wherever I can. And the only way I see being able to do that, building relationships, and people have asked me, what would you do the first 100 days you went in? I would build relationships to convince my colleagues that I'm right, and I think others are like-minded with me, and try to build a coalition to start pushing back on this stuff. And I really pray that we end up with the right president, because without it, it's going to make it very difficult because of those departments.
Well, you have a very busy spring and summer up ahead with the campaign going on. The primary is in August, and I hope that we get a chance to talk again before then.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.